Parents, friends, faculty, fellows, and staff of PSI and Perimeter and of the University of Waterloo, and most of all, students of the PSI graduating class of 2013. Welcome to our PSI graduation ceremony. My name is John Berlinski, and I'm the Academic Program Director of the Perimeter Institute. I often comment on how strange a title this is, because Perimeter is not a degree-granting academic institution, it is a research institute. Nevertheless, students come here from around the world to conduct research under the supervision of Perimeter faculty toward their graduate degrees, both master's and PhD. PSI, Perimeter Scholars International, is a joint program of the University of Waterloo and Perimeter. Students do a coursework master's degree in which the courses and research supervision are provided by Perimeter, and the students are enrolled in and receive their degrees from the University of Waterloo. The current class arrived here in August 2012 from 15 countries around the world. Since then, they have attended lectures, done homeworks and tutorials, lived together in close proximity, taken their meals together, studied and played together, done research, written essays, and presented and defended their results. This is an intense and bonding experience, and the physics they have learned and the friendships they have formed will stay with them for a lifetime. Because the PSI course ends late, after the university's June convocation, our students' real graduation, when they receive their university diplomas, is not until next October. Today, they receive their PSI certificates, which signify that they have successfully completed all the requirements of the program and that PSI will recommend to the University of Waterloo that they receive their degrees at the fall convocation. In light of the close partnership of the Perimeter Institute and the University of Waterloo, it is fitting that our first speaker should be a representative of the university. Professor Brian McNamara is a well-known astronomer and cosmologist whose research centers on the physics of supermassive black holes. He is also director of the Guelph-Waterloo Physics Institute, which oversees the physics graduate programs of those two universities. GWPI is the largest physics program in Canada, involving over 90 faculty and over 200 grad students, including our 30 PSI students. Please join me in welcoming Professor McNamara.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for being here. 1 year ago, I stood here speaking to the third class of PSI graduates. I recalled PSI's beginnings as a scribble on Neil Turok's notepad and contrasted that to the going concern PSI is today. In only a few short years, led by John Berlinski and his team, PSI has grown from a notion to a world-renowned program that in only its fourth year received over 300 applicants for only 30 coveted spots. The term experiment does not come up frequently in a theoretical physics institute, where beakers and test tubes give way to blackboards and qubits. As all of you know, the best theoreticians pay close attention to the results from their experimental colleagues. But your day-to-day routines are concerned with integrals, derivatives, actions. Actually, you are all part of an experiment. The Perimeter Institute itself is a great experiment. Who would have thought a world-beating theoretical physics institute would spring up in Canada? Certainly not in Waterloo. We've all heard this. Waterloo? Where is that? Near Toronto? Can the Canadian private and public sectors work together to provide the world with needed breakthroughs in theoretical physics? Can it happen in Waterloo? Well, yes, it can. but it is an experiment, and like any good experiment, we don't quite know what the outcome will be. Like all good experiments, we have a strong experimental design that will, in time, yield an answer. Within this larger experiment, we are engaged in a more modest, but no less ambitious one, Perimeter Scholars International. This experiment is different. It's risky. We are constantly reevaluating, optimizing the experimental design. Are 6-week courses too short? Should we emphasize depth at the expense of breadth? Should we issue grades? And if so, what would be lost and what would be gained? How do we introduce research into the curriculum? And of course, are we succeeding? These are difficult questions to answer, but no matter what, we never lose sight of our most important experimental outcome, nurturing creativity through diversity. I don't know precisely why Neil and John chose not to introduce grades into the Sci curriculum, but I have an idea. They understood that nurturing creativity is more important than grading performance. Those of us who've made a career in science have learned that the smartest kid in the room, we all kind of know what that is, you know, the one with the highest grades, is not necessarily the one who in the long run makes the big breakthrough. The thrill of the breakthrough requires more than technical skill. It demands imagination and creativity. What is dark energy? How did the universe form and how will it end? Will it end? Is there physics beyond the standard model? The questions go on and on. The needed breakthroughs in physics are so difficult, so demanding, that we must draw the best talent, the most creative young people from around the world if we have any hope of solving them. The University of Waterloo's graduate physics program recently had its 7-year review. The external evaluation committee, comprised of 2 eminent physicists, commented, and I quote, "The cultural diversity of students at Waterloo and Perimeter Institute was remarkable. Physics and astronomy are so international that a diverse student body and faculty are a requirement today for any world-class institution." Dr. Turok spoke to us about his vision for the Sci program and for the PhD program located at the Perimeter Institute. The unique facilities and star researchers are a platform for truly innovative approaches to graduate education in theoretical physics, end quote. You arrived from 15 different countries, bringing to Waterloo a diversity of cultural, economic, and scientific backgrounds. For all of you, Psi has been a struggle. Each of you share a need to solve difficult and important problems. Psi presented you with some of the most interesting, important, and complex unsolved problems in physics. We exposed you to many of the tools you will need to solve them. Your problem sets have been completed, your essays have been written, and now it's your time. Choose the hardest and most important problems to solve. If you want to make a breakthrough, you can't make it unless you're solving and attempting to solve important problems. Experiment, take risks, and by all means, innovate. Move into your future knowing that no matter where you come from, where you came from, or where you land, you will always have a home in Waterloo. Thank you, and the best of luck to each of you.
Thank you, Brian, for your kind words about Psi and for your encouraging remarks. It has become the tradition at Psi each year to invite an outstanding physicist to give an address at graduation and to receive an honorary Psi certificate. This year's honorary certificate winner is Art MacDonald, professor of physics at Queen's University, leader of the SNOW collaboration of the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, and a member of the board of directors of the Perimeter Institute. In the second half of the 20th century, the solar neutrino problem was one of the great mysteries of science. nuclear physicists could calculate the rate of neutrino production from the sun. According to the standard model, there are three flavors of neutrinos, the electron, the muon, and the tau neutrinos. However, only electron neutrinos are created in the sun. Experiments sensitive mainly to electron neutrinos detected only a fraction, a third or a half, of the neutrinos that were predicted. Where were the missing neutrinos? Art and the Snow team helped answer this question by building a giant neutrino detector consisting of 1,000 tons of heavy water at the bottom of a nickel mine in Sudbury, Ontario, and comparing their results for the number of electron neutrinos to those of a Japanese experiment, Super Kamiokande, and of a later Snow experiment that had some sensitivity to all three kinds of neutrinos. The combination of these experiments showed that all three flavors of neutrinos were present in equal numbers. The electron neutrinos were not missing. Some of them had just changed their flavor. The results can be understood in terms of neutrino oscillations and the neutrinos having mass. What does this mean? That is why every family needs a Psi student. If you ask, they can explain all of this to you. So to make a long story short, Art and his team solved a major problem in physics by demonstrating how new physics beyond the standard model occurred. Their discoveries have brought great recognition to the group, and as group leader, Art has been the recipient of awards that are too numerous to mention. Having said that, let me mention some of them. He has been awarded at least 6 honorary doctorate degrees since 1986 from universities in Canada and the US. He is a fellow of the Royal Societies of Canada and of the UK and the Commonwealth, as well as of the American Physical Society. And he is an officer of the Order of Canada. In 2003, he won the Bonner Prize in Nuclear Physics from the American Physical Society, the Medal for Lifetime Achievement from the Canadian Association of Physicists, the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada Award of Excellence, and the Gerhard Hertzberg Canada Gold Medal for Science and Engineering. In 2006, the Snow team received the NSERC John Polanyi Award, and in 2007, Art was co-recipient of the Benjamin Franklin Medal in Physics. Finally, this summer, the Snow collaboration, together with the Japanese Super Kamiokande group, will receive the 2013 Giuseppe Invano Cocconi Prize of the European Physical Society for an outstanding contribution to particle astrophysics and cosmology in the past 15 years. The world recognizes great accomplishments in physics, as we are doing here today. I would like to invite Art MacDonald to come forward to accept this honorary Psi certificate and to address the graduating class.
Thank you very much, John. It is indeed an honor for me to be asked to speak to the graduating Psi class today. You're a unique group of students in theoretical physics, selected from, as John said, a very large number of applicants from all over the world. You've been taught by a select group of professors in a wide variety of topics in physics, and you've been very creative in your work, producing high-quality final essays, ranging from very mathematical theory to experimentally motivated physics topics. I personally understand where you are in your career today because I myself was at exactly that same point in 1965 after having decided to take a one-year experimental master's degree at Dalhousie University in Halifax after completing my BSc there the year before. So 48 years ago, I think that's probably, some of your parents were probably born since that time. So 48 years ago, I was about to head for Caltech to complete my PhD in nuclear physics, and my master's thesis topic was the first measurement of temperature dependence of positron annihilation lifetimes in metals. Actually, my supervisor was Innes McKenzie from the University of Guelph, who was at Dalhousie at the time. It turns out that that PhysRev letter, in fact, is among my highest cited papers, except for the ones based on the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, which of course occurred much later in my career. Now, I understand, in fact, that you, in fact, have papers being submitted on the work that you have done this year. I predict that you'll look back with pride on your early career work, as I do on that work I did as a master's. So you can tell that I've been working in physics for a long time, starting as an undergraduate about 53 years ago. I actually found that the year I spent concentrating on my master's degree was very valuable as a stepping stone to my graduate studies. You learned how to be a theoretical physicist in your last year, and during that year I learned how to be an experimental physicist, and it really turned out to be valuable when it came to my future graduate work. Through my later career in nuclear and particle physics, I pursued a whole set of measurements of very fundamental quantities using a variety of experimental techniques in nuclear and particle physics. Started with studying the violation of charge symmetry in nuclei, violation of parity in nuclear processes, which was really a study of the standard model of Z exchange, in fact, between nucleons. And then I went on to study neutrino properties and their relevance to the standard model, or really an exceptions to the standard model. This also involved an understanding of solar physics, and now I'm working at SNOLAB on study of neutrinoless double beta decay and on the detection of dark matter particles. So I can tell from the list of topics in your final essays that you are also interested in the pursuit of fundamental physics questions, in your case, predominantly via theory. Let me try to explain a few things that I've learned through about, 50 years or so of that pursuit experimentally, and try to see if I can relate things in common that you will encounter in your primarily theoretical studies. First, let me suggest a way that you can always understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. I, as a director of this major physics project using all kinds of taxpayers' money for the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, got called upon to answer questions typically in a 30-second soundbite from a reporter or something, someone like that. It's really tough to do that, and it's particularly tough to do it in a way that's understood by non-specialists. So my suggestion to you, in order for you to understand, is for you to pick someone in your home neighborhood and try to see if you can explain what you're doing and why in no more than 3 30-second sound bites. I suggest to you that if you cannot make your motivation for doing what you're doing clear to a layperson in less than 3 30-second sound bites, then maybe you don't really understand yourself why you're doing it, at least not the basis of it. And so you should think very carefully if that's the case, and it's an excellent way for you to maintain your motivation and your focus on your work. At the same time, doing that will cause you to focus on how your work is of general value to the general public, and that's a very important thing to always keep in mind. Perimeter Institute is a wonderful example, of a place where outreach to the public is a very important priority. I encourage you to continue this tradition personally wherever you go. We scientists are really very privileged to be able to pursue our work with support from the general public of our various countries. You are among the very best young scientists of your generation in your respective countries. I encourage you to carry this approach to outreach wherever you go, here or in other countries, including your home country. Practice this simple approach and you'll not only be able to explain to others why your work is important, but you will be able to explain it to yourself, and that can result in quite natural changes in your career directions. In my case, I went from relatively small, few-person nuclear physics experiments to quite large international collaborations and changed technology substantially over the period. And The technology, in fact, that you experience today didn't exist when I started. It's a very different scientific world back then. For example, in my third year at Dalhousie as an undergraduate, they lifted the latest IBM computer through the roof of the physics department with a crane. I'm sure it had less capability than the BlackBerry Q10. It was programmed with punched cards, and of course there was no internet at all back then in the early 1960s. However, some things don't change. They picked two of us as undergraduates and said, learn Fortran and teach the professors. Now, my experience is that for the last 50 intervening years, it's always been the youngest generation, your generation, that understands best the latest in computing and other technologies, and the professors have a lot to learn from you still today. So, and you have skills as young people that are different from us old folks. For example, when we needed to fly, quotes, underwater with a remotely controlled submarine in this 300 million bucks worth of heavy water that we were using in snow, a set of detectors that had to be brought in and attached at the bottom of the detector, we found that only people under about 25 had the skill, and probably also the experience from video games, to be able to do that job. There was a bunch of the older scientists, including one in particular, who was a level 2 ski instructor, a very, very capable individual, who simply couldn't do it as well as the young people. And so you should realize that your youthful ideas and your quickness of mind, bolstered by the type of fundamentals and mathematical ability that you've learned in the last year, can be a real advantage for you. Don't hesitate to be innovative. Young ideas have very often been the ones that have created breakthroughs. At the same time, since you now have connections via the internet that are unparalleled compared to the past, you have real advantages in terms of collaboration. And so I'll encourage you to take your youthful abilities and to collaborate very broadly with people of all ages, by the way. That combination of young innovation and older experience and perspective can often be just what's needed for progress. I certainly experienced in the Snow Project what can happen if one works creatively with people from all over the world. We had to build this ultra-clean, low-radioactivity detector the size of a 10-story building holding 1,000 tons of this very expensive heavy water, 2 kilometers down in an active nickel mine that was taking 5,000 tons of ore a day out of the mine on any given day. But we knew from the outset, from some very careful simulations we'd done, that if we could build it correctly and restrict the radioactivity, we could make the sorts of measurements that John described that would clearly show whether electrons from the sun changed their type before reaching the Earth, a big question at the time. Using heavy water, we could observe one reaction that was sensitive explicitly to electron neutrinos and another one that was equally sensitive to all neutrino types. And so by comparing those two, you could determine what fraction of the neutrinos reaching the Earth were still electron neutrinos. And remarkably, after about 15 years of work, we found that, in fact, by restricting the radioactivity completely or very substantially, we found an experimental result that essentially matched exactly what we had simulated for the case where 2/3 of the electron neutrinos were changing into other types. And so what I, and at the same time, by doing that, we confirmed that the effect was due to neutrino properties and not due to the sun. The solar models that predicted the number of neutrinos produced in the sun were very accurate, and so we were able to contribute to solar physics as well as to particle physics. So what are a few of the lessons that are learned by our experience that relate, I think, to what you're doing as well? First one is, think big. Don't shy away from difficult problems, but do your homework very carefully and make sure that your big ideas can be put on a solid footing, which is what we had to do in the first place in order to get the money, but also was very, very valuable when it came to the detailed design of the experiment. The same is true for your theoretical ideas. Put them on a solid footing. Secondly, build a collaboration with a variety of people who complement your own expertise. And that's where, of course, these days, the internet can be very useful in your creativity. Also, be humble and respect your collaborators. We were able to say for the Snow Project, where we built the whole detector as a giant clean room to restrict this radioactive background, that even the person that swept the floor was just as important as any other person in the for the success of the experiment. I like the story of a recent university graduate who arrives for his first job at a company just where at a time when there's been a spill of something, and he meets his supervisor, and the supervisor says, "Oh, well, we're rather busy right now. Would you mind taking this broom and helping us to clean up this mess we've got there?" And the graduate said, "But I'm a university graduate." And the supervisor said, oh, I'm sorry. Well, in that case, you hold the broom like this, and you sweep. To varying degrees, that approach to collaboration, that is willing to be humble and do anything that's necessary in order to achieve your final result, is true whether or not you're talking about sweeping the floor or whether you're talking about doing those other onerous tasks, such as detailed computation work late at night, that is necessary in order for your collaboration to be successful. The other thing I will suggest is that you pay very close attention to the experimental results in the area where you're working. In SNOW, we benefited greatly from close collaboration with skilled theorists with broad perspective, as well as with experimenters in the field. Bruno Pontecorvo, for whom the 100th anniversary of his birth is being celebrated this year, was a physicist who was equally at home in experiment and theory, and came up with some wonderful insights in a number of areas, particularly in neutrino physics. Back in the late 1940s, there's a little-known paper of his written when he was at the Chalk River nuclear labs here in Canada that suggested that, in fact, either the sun or nuclear reactors could provide a large enough source of neutrinos that they could be detected with a chlorine-based detector. I mean, this was 1948, I think he was proposing this. At that point, they didn't know the difference between neutrinos and antineutrinos, and therefore the difference between reactors and the sun. What he followed through in the 1950s with the suggestion that neutrino oscillations could occur for massive neutrinos, and then later that, in fact, before Davis had his results, that this might be observed for solar neutrinos. Really quite a remarkable individual. When I was at Caltech at graduate school in the late 1960s, John Bacall, the theorist, and Ray Davis, the experimentalist, were trying to work out whether or not you could design an experiment using this same chlorine. And of course, Davis went on to do it and won the Nobel Prize for it. Now, not all breakthroughs, however, come from this close experiment theory coupling. A number of cases exist where the identification of a beautiful mathematical symmetry turned out to be a true representation of reality, and those were game changers in a number of cases. Back in the 60s, when I was in university, Murray Gell-Mann predicted the existence of the omega minus particle using something that was referred to as the eightfold way in those days. And it was quite a remarkable synthesis of a large set of data in a beautiful mathematical symmetry. And of course, the predictions of the recently discovered Higgs boson were a result of a really beautifully constructed standard model theory. So following mathematical pathways to truth in physics theory has turned out to be a really valuable way to proceed in many cases. However, I caution you that you always have to keep your feet planted firmly in the knowledge of the latest experimental results, so that you will be skilled at recognizing whether your theory, no matter how beautiful mathematically, actually bears a relationship to the world around you, and therefore is physics as well. In this context, let me also caution you as theorists to pay enough attention to how experiments are actually carried out that you really understand the statistical and systematic uncertainties in the results you read in various papers. You need to develop the ability to understand what results you should pay attention to and what ones are probably wrong or are at least much less accurate than the authors claim. Finally, you should always remember that your biggest impact in science can be as an educator. You may make significant breakthroughs in theory for which you personally will be remembered, but later in your career, you'll probably find that some of your greatest joy will come from the accomplishments of others that you've helped along the way. How many times have you heard one of us old folks say proudly that someone was a student of mine? That's a very common phrase, and it's something that you, as you get older, will appreciate. In fact, Miriam was a student on the Snow Project. We're very proud of her. By educating others, you can multiply your accomplishments in a very satisfying way. You combine that with an ongoing commitment to outreach, and you'll have a very satisfying scientific career. So thank you very much for giving me this honor, and I wish you all the best with your future careers. Thank you.
So thank you, Art. I really appreciate your point of view, since, as you know, we are of the same generation. We both worked with punch cards. I also appreciate your advice to the students, which I interpret as a final assignment to the class, which is, by the end of the day, to explain in ways that they can understand to your friends and family the subject of your essay. And finally, I agree that the really important things that we learn are going to be from the young people of the generation that follows us. And so the next order of business is the valedictory address. This year is our custom. We have two valedictorians selected by their classmates. These are Karan Lee, who came to Psi from Trinity College of the University of Dublin in Ireland, and Ruben Varesen, who came from the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium. Karan and Ruben, would you please come up on the stage to present your address?
Welcome, everybody, to the weekly sociology colloquium. Today we'll be representing a recently finished research topic. And the title of our talk is An Investigation into the Effects of Social Isolation, an Intense Study on the Social Dynamics and Cognitive Processes of a Group of Young Adults.
So before we start, we want to give you a brief outline of what we're going to talk about today. So first we're going to introduce the study, tell you what we were investigating, present our methods, how we went about collecting our observations. Then we're going to introduce our observations, and these things come in three categories. So first we're going to talk about the social, then the emotional, then the academic observations we made from the study. And then finally we're going to end with some final remarks.
All right. So first, to explain the study and its aim, so we wanted to look at 30 young adults and investigate their reactions under certain stimuli, for example, social isolation and intense study. Originally, we also intended to apply stimulus of intense exercise.
But after scheduling our first football game, this kind of didn't end so well. So we decided we should kind of scrap that idea. It probably wasn't too ethical to enforce further intense exercise in our participants. So we kind of wanted to find a place where kind of emotional isolation and social isolation would be easy enough to come by. So of course our first idea was Waterloo, of course, in Canada.
And so we needed a certain subject to study which would give both opportunity of social isolation and intense study. So we needed a subject which was intense enough so that they wouldn't have time to reach out to different neighboring communities and get social activities there. So of course we had to do this again.
So we actually found this nice dilapidated kind of business conference center in Waterloo that would be kind of ideal for our experiment. So we kind of bought this, renovated, and decided to call it the Pruner Institute for theoretical physics.
And for this we of course need to fill it with physicists, so we had to get some, we hired some actors for quantum foundations research, some actors in quantum gravity, some actors in quantum information.
Of course we got some actual string theorists as well. That's good. And of course we wanted to find, you know, 30 good young aspiring physicists, so we kind of had over 300 applicants, so we kind of, to get a good statistical, you know, sampling of all these things, we just picked 30 people at random. It was great, 15 different countries, and these ended up being our participants, all these 30 beautiful people up here.
Right. So now we look at the methods we used to ensure the stimuli we wanted. So we wanted an intense study environment, so we got some top physicists, because they were actual physicists. We need to make sure that they didn't hang around too long, because otherwise they would figure out what was going on and maybe tell the students and ruin the whole project. So we had to make sure that after the 3-week window, our private chauffeur, so we had to make sure that that after 3 weeks they would be driven away blindfolded by our private chauffeur Werner. But this, of course, meant that all the courses had to fit in a 3-week window, which was, of course, good, because it increased the intense study environment by tenfold again.
That's great. Of course, we had to find a way to, like, observe our participants and make sure we could, you know, observe kind of the emergent social dynamics that were coming out of these stimuli that were being applied. So, of course, we had to get video cameras in all the rooms to observe our participants. And, of course, we passed this off by saying that these were there to record the lectures, to kind of stem any curiosity from our physicists as to why there are video cameras everywhere.
And so we then needed to condition our subjects such that we could ensure that our stimuli would be applied. And so what we did is that if they would enter the workroom to work and be socially isolated, it would be fine. But as soon as they tried to leave, stop work, right, the door was programmed to give electric shocks to the students.
Great. And of course, to make sure that the only stimuli that were being applied to our students were just the ones we applied, you know, social isolation and all that kind of stuff, we kind of had to provide ample nutrition for our students to make sure that any, you know, anomalous behavior in their social dynamics was just due to things that we were applying. So we had this bistro, it was great, and that applied great food from, you know, breakfast on Monday to lunch on Friday. So we had some great nutrition there.
And so we now move on to the results of our study. So again, we have three parts, right? We first have the social results, after that we'll do the emotional results, and then the academic results.
So the first kind of thing we observed was we kind of observed this weird trend of social activity as opposed to time spent in Waterloo. So we plotted this thing here, and our students arrived, and we see this nice increase in social activity as they started to form social bonds and connections with each other, some friendships. Then we see some like incredibly fast behavior, and this is, of course, associated with the discovery of Chainsaw, which is a local karaoke bar down in Waterloo here. And as we see from our next file photo, this is a karaoke bar, things that went on there.
And then the front-end courses started. There was a certain decline in social activity.
Then we hit the first core course, declined again.
We had our first interviews.
Then, of course, the second core course.
And the second interviews.
Arriving at our third core course.
And then finally, the third interviews. So we've kind of hit rock bottom here. But before we go on, we want to investigate, for example, here. It all seems flat on these pieces, but actually, if we zoom in.
If we take more of a fine-grained approach in here, we see this kind of nice periodic behavior going on here. Our three peaks are, of course, associated with our 3 weekends in a particular psych course. And we see some actually nice social behavior going on here, like to do with the weekends, these nice peaks. So we had like the sharing of cultures. So this is Argentinian Independence Day. We all shared some nice food.
Here we have St. Paddy's Day.
Then we had Australia Day. And again.
Here we are celebrating Thanksgiving. And similarly, we also celebrated Chinese New Year.
And we also had the exchange of cultural foods, like some tasty Belgian pancakes. It was good.
Celebrating birthdays.
So like, celebrating birthdays is quite a normal social experience that people experience in a nice social peer group. But again, we see some strange kind of social dynamics coming out of this because of the applied stimuli, this intense study, and the social isolation. So of course, we got these weird kind of social dynamics going on. And again, we observed some other strange behavior going on in the social dynamics of our group.
All right. So now we're here, right? This is just before Christmas break. So now we will discover a quick recovery period. So there's a first big jump. This is due to Secret Santa. And this seems healthy again. But then again, there's this anomalous behavior that, for example, certain gifts are maybe too much for the more soft people in the audience.
And then we see another further increase in the social activity because we're getting closer to Christmas, and this is associated again to nice activities like the collective watching of Christmas films together, as we see in the next file photo, and of course, you know, the shared cultural heritage of Christmas.
And then the final big bump is there.
It's quite a steep increase, like it's further than anything we've had before, and it's of course associated with a night out at Beta, like this. Course.
Okay, so now we had this period of rapid recovery in the holidays, and then the review courses start again. And so, instead of slowly falling back again, there seems to be a sort of hysteresis effect, where the subjects seem to have a certain memory, where they remember this harsh period before the recovery, and so fall back down again.
But we see this nice slight increase, so our subjects seem to be like adjusting to all these applied stimuli. But also, this is kind of associated with some weird kind of desperate social behavior to go on. Like, we see this associating with our peer group. We really want to, like, expand their peer group, include new members. And, of course, the only people they have social access to are their lecturers. So, of course, they try to desperately include the lecturers in their peer group by having dinner with Barton Zwieback, one of our lecturers who taught us string theory.
And, of course, we also went to the bar with Mark and Barton. So, here we see Mark Wise, if you might remember. And here, Barton Zwieback, as beautiful as ever.
Oh, of course, yeah. So this kind of behavior seems, in some sense, you know, normal. They're trying to include more people in their peer groups, but it kind of gets a bit perverse as we go on. They have this need to really include new people in their groups, and this stretched as far as including inanimate objects as part of their peer group. For example, this nice, luminous, green, inflatable Canadian kangaroo or Australian kangaroo. Sat in some lectures with us as well. Join our peer group. It was good.
All right. So we now had this somewhat nice increase in social activity, which seems positive, albeit maybe a bit unhealthy, but still there was an increase. But then, of course, there were the SciSA, we got started, and there was a bit. So we see we have a singularity at the SciSA defense with the asymptote there.
And as we've seen before, our subjects showed, you know, remarkable resilience to these applied stimuli. As we see before, around Christmas, you know, there was an increase in social activity after the hit rock bottom. So of course, it's to be expected that there would be some increase in social activity after the essay defense. And of course, this was helped by the advent of Canada's Wonderland.
Here we see a new singularity. And
of course, from this file photo, we see why that was the case. It's good.
All right, so those were the social results. Then we have the emotional results, of course, which is a bit shorter. Kieran?
So we kind of observe that like changes in the environment of our participants. A small change in the environment of our participants kind of had some big emotional impact on them. So as we see the start of the first day of winter, like the first day of snow, we see some really exuberant kind of emotional behavior going on. It was great. But then after a certain time, as the winter dragged on, they started to get quite depressed. But then again, when we see a change in the kind of environment of our participants, like the first day of summer, like we had some nice sun, the snow was gone, we see exuberance again. So this would lead us to kind of conjecture that any change in the environment of our participants would lead to a kind of emotional response. And we really wanted to see if this was a repeatable phenomenon. So we wanted to try and create a circumstance in which we create a change in the environment and see if that, you know, had a corresponding emotional response. So we decided to take the Friday social, in which our participants had a free drink every Friday, and change that to, instead of being once a week, to being once a month, and try and observe the kind of emotional impact. And of course, there was outrage, absolute outrage. So we have confirmed that conjecture.
Right, and this inspired us even more. We wondered, maybe any sudden arbitrary change in the environment results in rather strong, immense emotional responses. And to test this again, we chose an arbitrary thing, and normally every day they can get free fresh juices in the bistro. We said, no more fresh juices. You can only get for free juices in a can. And again, there was great emotional disturbances, so it seems to be.
Yeah. So we've confirmed that conjecture as well. So now we kind of have, we see this kind of tendency in our social, in the, our study, for them to go out and find social activities that kind of would have a big emotional impact for a small input, because they're, you know, socially isolated. There's intense study being applied to them, so they don't have that much time to that, and so they want a good social activity where a small input would result in a large emotional output. So of course they discovered the pool table, and this was great for a while. There was a great emotional response from that, and then it just wasn't enough after a while. They needed more out of it, so they created the pool league. And then lots of people were playing that and getting lots of emotional stimuli out of that, but it just wasn't enough. And this led to the discovery of the foosball table, table football. And then again, we had a football table league, because it just wasn't enough emotional response out of just playing foosball. And of course...
Well, so again, normally the same fate would happen. People would not be satisfied enough with this anymore. But instead of releasing their last simple joy they had in life, they lashed onto it. But the only way to do that was to make it a bit more perverse, and they had to add one more special characteristic to the game called the crawl, which is if a person loses 0-8, he has to physically crawl underneath a table football. Here we see a... it's a random subject crawling under the table. And I can verify, having undergone this myself the first time yesterday, that it is quite denigrating.
It's okay. So a kind of positive offshoot of all these kind of observations and these intense stimuli we've been applying to our study have been, you know, a nice academic, you know, academic activity that kind of came out of this. So the first would be that our participants were like under such intense study that they actually were brought to such a high level of research that they're, you know, leaving a master's program ready to do actual research in theoretical physics, which is kind of really cool. We also saw that lots of students are now going on to well-known universities after their master's study, so it's kind of a positive offshoot of our study, something that we maybe didn't anticipate at the start, that they have this great kind of academic achievement going on at the end of it.
And we see even as a good influence on the social environment. We form collaborative groups, we help each other in works, and we even didn't have enough classes, so we created our own classes, and we created a seminar, which was excellent. But we're going to add, so these are the results, but we're going to add some further remarks maybe, some final remarks.
So all kidding aside, guys, I think we've had a really incredible year this year, like a great experience, and I know that the two of us will really cherish it for the rest of our lives. And I guess I'd love to thank every single person in this room and a lot of people outside it for helping contribute to such an amazing experience. I know I'll never forget it, so thanks for that.
Yeah, it's been absolutely great. And I just have to think of this quote from Jonathan Toledo. So if you go on the Perimeter Scholar site, there's this videos from the students, mm-hmm. right? And one of the videos from the first year, I think, was Jonathan Toledo saying, you know, taking courses at Psy, it's like drinking from a water hose. And throughout the year, I kept thinking about that, and I realized it's such an accurate description. But even more so, I also realized that, you know, drinking from a fire hose, maybe that's how you should live life. Mm. And I want to thank everyone. But of course, I won't name any specific names, because as soon as you name one person, 1,900 people are upset. So just thank everyone for the amazing year. And let's all appreciate the opportunity we got. It's been amazing. And let's all carry it into the future. Thank you.
Thanks.
And one last thing, and because we know you want to see it again, here's the beautiful...
So, thank you, Ruben and Karan. Actually, it occurred to me as you were standing up here introducing your subject that in previous years, we had always asked the valedictorians to submit their speech the day before the graduation. So, Debbie, make a note of that. Thank you. Okay, so now for the purpose for which we're here, we will now present certificates to the Psy students. These symbolize that they have completed the requirements of the Psy program and that recommendations will be brought to the University of Waterloo Senate that they be approved for graduation at the fall convocation. Students should come up on the stage to receive their certificates as their names are called, and I'll call on Tibra and Dan to call out the names. And Brian.
Natasha Belen Altamirano. Kai. Andre Katananu. Yanggang Chen. Miriam Diamond. Nicholas Garant Jones. Jun Young Koo. Dax Enshan Ko. Tian Lan. Kiran Lee. Yuren Arthur Lee. Jinyu Lee. Gabriel McGill. Daniel Xavier Ogburn.
Chiamaka Blessing Okoli. Quoc Trung Pham. Junji Rao. Marie Ryder. John Selby. Cedric Sanamuli Musama. Dominique Soutier. Annabelle Spinulas. Alexandra Tarana. C.
Sergio, Camilo, Vargas, Avila. Ruben Varenson. Martin Visca. Jinmen Wong. Nicole Younger Halpern.
So it's a great pleasure to congratulate the Scions on completing their program. As you've heard, Sci is extremely intense and challenging. These students have worked hard and performed well. It was particularly inspiring to chair the presentations of their essays, which showed how far they had come and how much they had mastered in less than a year, as well as demonstrating the great diversity of culture and style of the men and women in this international class. For the students, I would add that you now move on to the next stage where what you have learned will provide the base for future accomplishments. Whether it is a PhD in physics or some other subject, or to a job and career, your success and accomplishments will be the reward for those of us who have helped you along the way. This applies not only to the Sci and Perimeter teams, but also to your families and friends, and particularly to your parents. We will derive pleasure from your accomplishments, but this will be particularly pleasing if you find satisfaction and enjoyment in what you do in life, wherever your careers may lead. So that concludes today's program. Before closing, I would like to give special thanks to those responsible for organizing this event, Debbie Gunther and Diana Goncalves, who worked tirelessly on this over the past few weeks while the rest of us read and listened to essays. And also to David Fairthorn and Laura DeDecker, who handled the audiovisuals and recording of this ceremony, and Jessica Lee, who decorated the blackboards. So thank you all for that. On behalf of Sci, I'd like to thank all of you who came to this event. I look forward to meeting as many of you as possible during the rest of the day. Now, please follow us and the students into the atrium where light refreshments will be served. Thank you.